This morning is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Mark Richards, who is a nephrologist here practicing in Boca Raton. He's actually also in our CME committee and helps us plan these grand rounds, so I appreciate all of his help. Dr. Richards went to the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. He was actually in the inaugural class at FAU and then finished down at Miami. He did his internal medicine residency at the University of North Carolina Hospitals and then did his fellowship in nephrology there also. Subsequently, he moved down to Florida where he's been practicing ever since. And this morning he's going to give us a talk on peritoneal dialysis, underutilized and underappreciated.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming. And so, I don't know, I feel like the reason I wanted to talk about peritoneal dialysis is that it's becoming a little bit more common than we realize. It's slowly growing, and if I have my way, it will be fastly growing. And I think a lot of people are just not familiar with it. Especially when patients come into the hospital, people almost look at the patients if they have seven heads. They have no idea how to manage it, what to do. And so I thought a grand rounds lecture to sort of talk about how it works, what are some barriers to us getting people on peritoneal dialysis, maybe what are some of the complications people worry about, hopefully will help, enhance the conversation a little bit. So I have nothing to disclose. And so again, we'll talk a little bit about the epidemiology of peritoneal dialysis. We'll talk about some of the barriers that are preventing patients from starting it. We'll talk about the mechanism, how we write a prescription, how patients go about their day, how they're monitored. And then finally, we'll talk a little bit about the infectious and the non-infectious complications of peritoneal dialysis. So I feel like I pretty much start any of my grand rounds lectures with a slide like this. So chronic kidney disease is a growing epidemic. It affects about 1 in 10 adults in the United States. In 2011, there were about 28 million people with some form of chronic kidney disease. Obviously, that advances through different stages. And finally, when patients are getting down to stage 5 or a kidney function of around 15%, that's when we start considering patients as, when we have to start the conversation about transitioning to end-stage kidney disease therapies or dialysis or preferably a transplant. As you're well aware, the most common causes of kidney disease in the country are high blood pressure and diabetes. About 1 in 5 hypertensive patients develop kidney disease. 1 in 3 diabetics develop kidney disease. And also patients who have underlying vascular disease are prone to it as well. So in the United States, there's current, as of a couple of years ago, there's about 660,000 patients in the country who have end-stage kidney disease, and that's out of about the 30 million adults that have it. So I always try to reassure the patients that come into my office that most of them will not develop end-stage kidney disease. Of those patients, about 475,000 are on dialysis, and about 185,000 people are living in the country with a transplant. In 2014, the incidence, about 121,000 people started dialysis throughout the country. And we have over about 100,000 patients on the transplant list. And so and in 2015, only about 19,000 transplants were performed. So, obviously we need to optimize our dialysis techniques to, hopefully bridge as many patients as possible until they can get a transplant. So I guess a question that I have for you, it's something I think about, I don't know if that makes me weird or just a nephrologist, is have you ever thought about what type of dialysis you would want for yourself if you became end-stage kidney disease? I knew Baca would. Any thoughts? What would you... Obviously, no one ever wants dialysis for anyone, especially themselves. But, what would be the least unideal way to do it? So potentially at home therapy, peritoneal dialysis, so what's interesting is so in America, that's not what we do for our patients. It's about 89% of our dialysis patients in the United States do in-center hemodialysis. And only about 11% of patients do their dialysis at home. And as you can see, a majority of those patients are doing peritoneal dialysis, and we have a very small population of home hemodialysis patients. But over the last several years, there actually has been a rise in the number of patients that are starting peritoneal dialysis. Maybe it's gone up about 10,000 patients over the last 10 years. Part of that was actually there's Can you think of why there's maybe an incentive for us to put patients on peritoneal dialysis? There's only one incentive. Right. And so it turns out that, you know, end-stage kidney disease is a huge part of the Medicare budget. About 7.2% of Medicare claims, or $35 billion, was spent on dialysis patients in 2016. And if you kind of the cost down by patient per year, to maintain a patient on hemodialysis cost about $91,000 a year. To maintain a patient on peritoneal dialysis cost about $76,000 a year. So that's a lot of savings if accumulating over tens or hundreds of thousands of people. And obviously, those both pale in comparison to transplant, which is much more cost effective in the long run, about $36,000 a year. So the culture of limited number of patients on peritoneal dialysis, it doesn't really apply to other parts of the world. And so this, I don't know if you can see this. These are percentage of patients on peritoneal dialysis by developed country. And so the U.S. is all the way down here with about 7% of patients on PD. The gold, silver, and bronze medalists, actually in Hong Kong, about 80% of patients are on peritoneal dialysis. New Zealand is about 36%, and Sweden is about 24%. And then you can see UK is about 17%, Canada's at 18%. And so there definitely has been a push more towards home therapies in other countries throughout the Western or developed world. So I kind of going back to that question I asked you a few minutes ago. A survey was sent out to a bunch of nephrologists and nephrology nurses about 10 years ago, asking that question: what would we want for ourselves? And it turns out, basically, it's the inverse of what we do for our patients. It turns out 93% of nephrologists and nephrology nurses would want a home therapy, and only 5-6% of patients want what we do for a majority of our patients, which is doing dialysis 3 days a week in a center. And it's split pretty much between home hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis. So the question is why, what are some of the barriers that are preventing us from doing for our patients what we want to do for ourselves? And so part of that is whenever I see a patient in the clinic, my first thought is always, how can I get this patient on peritoneal dialysis? Are they a good candidate? And so some of the things I think about are, the advantages and disadvantages of each modality. Obviously, with peritoneal dialysis, what I value would be the independence. Instead of coming into the office or coming into our dialysis clinic 3 days a week or, 12 to 15 times a month for treatment, I'm in and out for two appointments a month, one to check in with the nurse and get my labs drawn, and once to, see the doctor and see the team, the nutritionist, social worker, et cetera. So it's a lot more, you're a lot more independent than if you're on hemo. At the same time, it's more physiologic. Instead of trying to cram 168 hours of kidney function into 12 hours a week of hemo, a lot of patients are on peritoneal dialysis continuously. It's like even during the day or at night, they're always doing dialysis. And that can lead to better electrolyte clearance, less problems with hyperkalemia, hyperphosphatemia, et cetera. Obviously, in our aged population in Boca, some of the disadvantages can apply, and that's what often will limit me. Some patients don't like that it's every day. At the same time, patients like showing up at the dialysis clinic and turning their brains off and just, getting their treatment and going home. A lot of patients also have issues with cognition, with dexterity, where they, might not be able to manipulate the circuit as well at home. And also maybe issues with vision. However, Dr. Lazar actually had a blind patient on dialysis for several years on PD. These are, again, the things I think about over time. Disadvantages of peritoneal dialysis, there's a lot of the complications that we'll talk about later. There can be issues with access, just like with any modality of dialysis. As we'll talk about, we use dextrose-based solutions to achieve ultrafiltration. That can lead to a lot of hyperglycemia in patients, especially in patients who are diabetic. And over time, the peritoneal membrane can poop out over time and lead to switching modalities. So again, the barriers, the really only absolute barrier, though, is does a patient have a functioning peritoneum? If you don't have one, you can't do dialysis. But again, relative complications: did the patient have a history of abdominal surgeries? Do they have abdominal scarring? Or do they have impairment, whether physical, dexterity or able to, you know, kind of do some sort of fine motor movements. However, a lot of patients actually have some of our patients have help for this. You know, their living situation. Obviously, we want patients to be in a relatively clean environment with access to quality water, and also have their, you know, where they do their dialysis close to, you know, a sink or a toilet to dispose of the fluid. And some patients who are anuric who don't have any residual kidney function, sometimes it's harder to obtain your actual the goal clearance. Sometimes if patients are larger, it's a little bit more difficult to do that as well. And then finally, if patients have hernias, it could also make it a little bit more difficult because that can lead to complications over time. And again, what makes a good peritoneal dialysis candidate? I mean, the starter and really is, does the patient want to do their own dialysis? Do they want to take responsibility for doing dialysis at home? But obviously, if a patient is younger, if they're working, if they have residual kidney function, if they don't have a history of abdominal surgeries, you know, if their home environment is sound, pretty much, you know, these are things that would make for an ideal candidate. But again, I'm trying to, even in patients who have some of these relative barriers, I'm trying to figure out if they would be interested in trying it at home and if they would be a good candidate. And again, if it's not like if you make this commitment, you're stuck. If peritoneal dialysis doesn't work out for some reason, you can easily switch modalities. Or the other way around, if patients don't like hemodialysis, they can easily switch over to PD. And so in terms of the peritoneal dialysis catheter placement, this is what a Tankoff catheter looks like. So you can see there's an external segment that sort of goes gets tunneled into the abdominal fat here. And you see these two little kind of squares. These are cuffs, which help kind of and these get tunneled in, one usually in the fat and one in the muscle. And this helps maintain, keep the catheter in place, but also it serves as multiple barriers to try to prevent skin flora, skin bacteria from getting into the peritoneal cavity. And then finally, you have a intraperitoneal segment, which ends up kind of curling around. And usually, we like this catheter to be placed, you know, usually a month or so before the patient starts dialysis. Some centers will actually do what's called a catheter burial, where they'll set everything up like normal, but they'll actually take the external segment and sort of slide it into the subcutaneous space and just leave it there until the patient needs it. And then the surgeon can actually make a very simple incision and express the catheter to use it. There's really no good data about which modality is better, and I don't think we do tunneling here. But regardless, usually once the catheter is placed, we like to wait about 2 weeks just to let everything heal up and form a nice seal. And usually we'll have the patient come into our office once a week to flush the catheter with either saline or dialysate just to make sure it's working and patent. And then usually we'll have the patient will train with our nurse for a couple of weeks where they'll, you know, I think patients are always very scared of sort of going out on their own, but we have a really good protocol in place for, you know, talking to patients, training them, you know, in the art of sterile technique, how to prevent infection, because obviously peritonitis is a big deal. And our nurse will even go to the patient's house to make sure everything is set up okay. And they're always available if there are any questions. I didn't really go into it in this lecture, but in other parts of the world, especially more in the developing world, you can actually do urgent start peritoneal dialysis where you can put the catheter in and use it the same way. Obviously, there's a higher risk of leaking, but there's ways to go around that. But it can be used. We don't really do that here or in the United States, but it definitely is an option. Probably the main reason is that in other parts of the world, you can actually do dialysis without electricity. And so we'll talk about that in a little bit. And so again, the catheter, when it's put in, obviously we don't want the exit site to be sort of near a belt loop or anywhere where it might be uncomfortable for the patient. And then the catheter is always is aimed inferiorly, and it ends up curling in the lower pelvis. And the reason for that is that it just functions better down there, and it's the best place to put the catheter to avoid the omentum, which oftentimes the catheters can get kind of tied up in them, which can impair their ability to function. And so if you're ever looking for the proper positioning of a PD catheter, you can do an abdominal X-ray. And so it's a little hard to see, so I put a little pulsy graphic there. And you can see here it's like the catheter is nicely tunneled down into the pelvis, which is right where it's supposed to be. And so then we'll talk a little bit about the peritoneal dialysis prescription. So all patients are trained in what's called CAPD, or continuous ambulatory peritoneal dialysis. And so if a patient ever talks about doing manual exchanges at home, that's what that involves. And again, this is a great, all patients, especially in Florida, have to learn it this way. Basically, in the event that there's a hurricane and there's no power, so they know how to do this, keep themselves going until their power can be restored, and they can resume what's called automated peritoneal dialysis or continuous cyclic peritoneal dialysis. And that's using this machine here, which is a cycler. In the United States, a majority of patients use the cycler. It's obviously a lot more convenient for patients. Usually what patients do is they actually hook themselves up to the machine when they go to sleep, and they disconnect themselves when they wake up. It's almost like an extra, thing that they do when they, wash up for bed or get ready in the morning. It's just like one extra step and becomes part of the daily routine. At the same time, we usually will set the machine to do several overnight exchanges, and I'll go into that in a couple of slides. So here's another kind of a cartoon of the apparatus. And so what sticks out of the patient's abdomen is that external segment that I showed you before. And then this extra piece is what's called a transfer set. And so there's different brands of peritoneal dialysis machines or cyclers, and they all have like their own kind of unique attachments. And so the transfer set basically connects this sort of generic segment of the catheter and makes it, and then when you add this extra piece, it can hook up to any type of machine. And so usually what we'll end up using is sort of a Y-shaped tube. And so where you can either hang a bag of solution or you have a bag on the heater for your cycler, it will go into your belly. And then if you want to disconnect, it will basically just go out the other side. And there's a mechanism that prevents fluid from kind of backwashing up. And really just by gravity, this works. This is sort of how the prescriptions are structured. On patients who do continuous ambulatory peritoneal dialysis or the manual exchanges, usually what ends up happening is you have about 4 or 5 periods throughout the day where you're doing manual drains and fills. So a patient will sit down, they'll drain their belly, and then they'll fill it with fresh fluid. And usually that period, that can take about 15 to 30 minutes. Obviously this is for people who, have the time to do it. But most patients prefer continuous cyclic or automated peritoneal dialysis, where they connect themselves to a cycler here, and the machine is programmed to do more rapid exchanges overnight. And then in some cases, especially if patients have residual renal function, we can leave the belly dry during the day, or we can do what's called a last fill, where we leave fluid in and they walk around with it all day. So patients are basically getting dialysis around the clock. Automated peritoneal dialysis remains more popular. There was an older study that noted that patients had a higher quality of life. There's less exchanges, which obviously is better for patient convenience. But some patients, they don't like kind of being tethered to the cycler. Because again, if you're putting yourself on the cycler, there's a little bit of slack to maybe do a little bit of moving around, but pretty much for 8 to 10 hours, during this time period, you're pretty much stuck in your bed or in your room, and you can't really do much without having to disconnect the circuit. So some patients just don't like that. There is some data that those patients who do the manual exchanges may have better preservation of their residual kidney function over a longer period of time, but there really is no difference. Just like there's no difference between hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis in really morbidity or mortality, so neither is really overall better than the other. There's really no difference in volume management as long as the prescription is done properly, and also there's no risk, and there's no change in risk of infection. And so here's how peritoneal dialysis works. And so in our peritoneum, we have a lot of tiny little arteries and veins and capillaries. And obviously, if a patient has end-stage kidney disease, there's a lot of waste products, there's a lot of salt and volume that is circulating around. And then what we do is we instill a dialysis solution in the belly. And we'll go over the contents in a little bit. But obviously, if you think about it, we use a lot of diffusion here. there's more bad things in the blood, and there's less bad things in the dialysate. So things will tend to diffuse from areas of higher concentration to areas of lower concentration. Likewise, we put more good things in the dialysate than there are in the blood, and those will migrate across as well. The question is, how do we get fluid out and ultrafiltrate our patients, especially if they're anuric? We need to pull fluid out. And the way to do that is using actually dextrose. And so we can use differing concentrations of dextrose. Remember, sugars are effective osmoles. And so by creating a significant sugar gradient in that peritoneal dialysis fluid, we can actually pull excess water out into the peritoneum, and then we can drain the belly, and we have net ultrafiltration. The bags that I'll show you later come in different concentrations, so you can actually turn up the percentage of dextrose in the solution to help pull out that extra volume. Everyone has, just like, I guess, snowflakes or whatever, everyone has a unique peritoneal membrane. And so we have to figure out what are the characteristics of someone's peritoneum and how can we sort of use that information to optimize a dialysis prescription. And so we do something called a peritoneal equilibrium test. This is, or as we call it, a PET test. It's sort of like the nephrologist version of calling the ATM the ATM machine. That's a horrible joke. But basically, what we do is usually within about a month after starting dialysis, we take patients and we bring them into our office. And what we do is we put PD fluid into the belly, about 2 liters of a dextrose-based solution. And obviously, as soon as you put that fluid in, all the creatinine is in a patient's blood, and there's nothing in the dialysate. So this is what's called the ratio of dialysate to plasma creatinine, and that starts off at zero. And basically what we do is at 2 hours we draw a sample of fluid out, and we measure the creatinine in the fluid, and then at 4 hours we measure it again. And so obviously, different peritoneal membranes transport, solutes quicker. And so if a lot of creatinine is like flying out of someone's peritoneal membrane, they're going to be what's called a high transporter. But some patients, it happens very slowly. And even after 4 hours, maybe they've only gotten about, 30, the ratio is only about 1 in 3. Those patients are low transporters. Most patients tend to be somewhere in the middle, either like a high average or a low average transporter, but we definitely have some anomalies who kind of stick out more towards the extremes. The other thing that we measure is the sugar, because remember, we're putting dextrose in to try to pull fluid out. And so what we'll measure in the dialysate bag is the ratio of the current glucose concentration of the dialysate, and we'll divide that by the dialysate at time zero. Because what happens is, just like as we're pulling out creatinine, there's a lot more sugar in the peritoneal fluid than there is in our blood. And so our body's going to reabsorb that. And so if that's getting reabsorbed quickly, patients, again, will be high transporters. But if the sugars are coming out much slower, then they tend to be lower transporters. And this is significant. This will significantly impact how we do our prescription. And we can show that here. So the creatinine clearance is basically the ratio of the dialysate creatinine to the plasma creatinine times the volume of distribution. And so basically as we showed before, patients who are higher transporters or rapid transporters are pulling creatinine out really, really fast. So pretty quickly, the creatinine in the fluid is going to equilibrate and be the same as the creatinine in the blood. And it almost forms like this asymptotic curve. The slower transporters tend to have more of a linear removal of creatinine. At the same time, we also measure ultrafiltration. So if we put 2 liters of fluid in someone's belly, a rapid transporter is going to, it's so rapid and there's so much sugar in there, fluid's going to come out really, really fast. But ultimately, as that glucose is reabsorbed quickly back into the body, you actually end up having a backwash. And if you leave that fluid in too long, you may actually end up net positive. Does that make sense? And so, whereas a slower transporter, you know, because the sugar is not moving across the peritoneal membrane into the body as quickly, you're going to get, again, more of a gradual improvement in ultrafiltration. And then if you if you divide these, the creatinine clearance by, or creatinine removal by the volume, you'll get a creatinine clearance per exchange, where, again, a slower transporter sort of have this slowly improving, you know, creatinine clearance the longer you leave fluid in the belly. A rapid transporter, again, will have great clearance early, but then if you leave that fluid in, they're going to have diminishing returns over time, which can limit, which could, you know, lead to inadequate dialysis. So basically, then when we come up with a peritoneal dialysis prescription, we have to kind of take this into consideration. So again, in patients who tend to be more rapid transporters, our goal is to do shorter, more frequent exchanges. So these are great patients for the cycler. You can put a patient on for 8 or 9 hours and do 4 or 5 exchanges, and so they end up only getting, like, the fluid only ends up staying in there for about, you know, maybe like 2 hours per exchange. So you're getting pretty good clearance, and you're getting out the maximum possible ultrafiltration after 2 hours. You know, but then again, if you want to dialyze someone throughout the day and leave fluid in their belly all day, they may end up losing a lot of that ultrafiltration if that is left in for several hours. Sometimes what we'll do is we'll have the patient put a last fill in, but after a few hours, then just drain their belly and have a dry majority of the day, almost like an extra exchange, without really the risk of losing the benefit of the cycler treatments. Slower transporters are on the contrary. They require longer dwells and less frequent exchanges. So something like, ambulatory or manual exchanges, maybe doing those four, an exchange when you go to sleep, an exchange when you wake up, and then 2 exchanges throughout the day, that and on average like 6-hour dwells, that might be better for a patient. Or maybe put the patient on the cycler just for a couple of exchanges at night and then leave that fluid in all day, and they may actually get better clearance and ultrafiltration in the long run. Average transporters, you can sort of pick and choose maybe what the patient prefers. Either modality is appropriate, and it really is based on patient preference. So the goal of an appropriate prescription, again, is what patients will do is we'll check their labs every month. We'll check electrolytes, markers of bone mineral metabolism, anemia, just like we would do in our hemodialysis patients. And then every 3 months, we measure what's called a KT over V, or basically a clearance. It's the best way of measuring like clearance of urea or other solutes per a certain volume of distribution. And this takes into account peritoneal dialysis fluid combined with a patient's residual kidney function. And I won't go into the gory details of how to calculate that, as we'll be here forever until next week's grand rounds. But the goal generally is to get a weekly KT. Usually you can, based on this information, if a patient brings in a bucket of their 24-hour urine, plus they end up bringing in all their PD fluid from overnight, which can end up being maybe, you know, 10 to 12, 15 liters based on their size. We bring it in and we actually measure how much urea comes out overnight, and then you can do these calculations and then multiply by 7 for 7 days in a week and get your weekly KT over V. And if it's over 1.7 combined, you're getting adequate dialysis. There's really not great data on making that number even better and better. Obviously, if we're there, great. But, you know, oftentimes, as long as we're getting a patient above like the 1.7 or 1.8 range, likely the patient won't have any uremic symptoms. They'll have hopefully adequate enough ultrafiltration, and they'll be able to go about their daily lives. And again, the goal is, you know, avoiding uremia. We obviously want to ultrafiltrate people. So what we'll have patients do is we'll have them weigh themselves daily. We'll have them check their blood pressure, check for swelling. And then we can also, you know, if we're having issues, we can, you know, mix and match different dialysis solutions. And also, we obviously want to maintain, you know, appropriate bone mineral metabolism, phosphorus levels, calcium levels, potassium levels, et cetera. So I don't know if any of you have ever taken care of a peritoneal dialysis patient or asked them about their prescription, but patients will always tell you, oh, I use, you know, 1 green bag and 1 yellow bag. And you would think, and so it's sort of like a weirdo traffic light. Because the 3 different concentrations of dextrose are 1.5% or 15 grams per liter, 2.5% or 25 grams per liter, or 4.25% or 42.5 grams per liter. And you can see, obviously, as the more dextrose there is, the higher the concentration or the osmolality, which should theoretically lead to higher rates of ultrafiltration. And so you would think that the 1.5 would be the green one, and just take my word for it. The yellow one is the lowest one. The green caps are on the 2.5%, and the red caps are on the 4.25%. The electrolytes vary, but on average, the sodium tends to be a little bit lower. The theory behind that is that because we're using diffusion to pull out all these different electrolytes, it actually creates a maneuver called convection or almost like solvent drag, which is going to pull out extra water. And so the fear is that if you had a sodium 140 solution, it can predispose patients to hypernatremia. And so we run the sodium a little bit hyponatremic just to prevent that. And usually when we do our monthly labs, we almost never see hyponatremia in our patients, even with this solution. We tend to run no potassium in the dialysate and calcium equivalents that are pretty similar and magnesium that are pretty similar to what's in our hemodialysis dialysate. And then our primary buffer is actually lactate. And so usually what we can then do, in rare cases, we can use citrate as well as a buffer to help balance acidosis. And in rare cases, you can use sodium bicarbonate, but it's very hard to mix in with the other electrolytes, and so which is why we don't tend to use it very much. And then if you need to, you can put other things into the solutions, like antibiotics, as we'll talk about later. In patients who tend to be very hyperglycemic, I don't think I've ever seen this. I don't know if Dr. Vinnick, have you ever put insulin in a patient's peritoneal dialysate? You can do that too. And also, you can use heparin if there's a risk for clot or if you see like fibrin in the fluid. And so, again, we'll kind of talk about the different dialysis prescriptions. I kind of alluded to them earlier. So, again, with the manual exchanges, usually it's 3 to 4 exchanges per day. Each exchange takes about 15 to 30 minutes. Usually when we write for a fill volume, you can do between 2 and 3 liters of dialysate per exchange. And generally, we tend to use the yellow or the green bags, the 1.5 or 2.5%. The 4.25%, it's good that that's a red bag because we almost like to use that only in the event of an emergency if patients are really, really volume overloaded. Too much of that can actually sort of fry the peritoneal membrane, and so we like to save that for sort of cases of last resort. And so what patients do is they have, again, like that Y-shaped valve that I showed you earlier. And it's all done. There's no electricity, which is why this is great after a natural disaster or maybe in a third world country or in a rural area where power is not as perseverant. But basically, you have a two-way valve. You put an empty bag below the patient's belly, and you drain out the fluid. And then you put a clamp. You undo a clamp, and then the clean fluid goes in. And again, the process takes about 15 to 30 minutes. And usually when we write for this, patients do it about 4 times a day. So they'll do it before they go to sleep. And then the patient's long dwell is when they're asleep. They do one in the morning, I guess afternoon, evening. And then this is the same one as when they go to sleep. And then when patients are on the cycler, usually when we write a prescription, we write that the patient's on the cycler about 8 to 10 hours. Obviously any more than that, and patients they're not appreciative of this because they end up being tethered in their bed for too long of a time period. Hopefully it just covers when they're sleeping. Usually we'll write for exchanges, usually 4 to 5 over those 8 to 10 hours. The average dwell time ends up being about 2 hours, but it can be a little less if you account for the time that it takes to actually drain and fill. Instead of the effluent going into a bag, we actually connect it to the patient's bathtub or toilet. And so the tubing will basically just take the fluid out and just put it down the drain, and it goes away. The only exception to that is when patients need to bring in their quarterly collections. Then we'll have a bag set up so we can collect their fluid to bring into the clinic. Again, the fill volume tends to be between 2 and 3 liters. We tend to use 1.5% or 2.5% dextrose. Whereas here, a patient with the manual exchanges, if a patient measures if you know that you're putting 2 liters in every time, you can actually measure how much fluid comes out. So if, say, 2.3 liters comes out on a manual drain, then over that 6 hours, the patient had an ultrafiltration of about 300 milliliters. And then if you multiply that by the number of exchanges, you can get out a liter plus a day. And obviously with different higher intensity dextrose solutions, you can get more out. With the cycler, it keeps track of the ultrafiltration automatically because obviously, for the most part, you're not saving the fluid; it's getting flushed. And if you ever look at a PD patient in the hospital, you can actually hit the little buttons on the machine. I promise you won't break anything, and it will tell you the total ultrafiltration overnight. It'll say, you know, several hundred milliliters or whatever. And then the other thing that, you know, some patients, especially if they have a lot of residual kidney function, this can go away and you can leave their belly dry during the day, but usually patients will benefit more if they're doing continuous dialysis throughout the day with a last fill. And so in terms of, and then so kind of the things that we'll do when we adjust the prescription are if a patient has poor clearance or if that KT over V number drops and becomes substandard, the main cause of that is a drop in residual kidney function. And so, you know, unfortunately, this can happen over time as patients stay on dialysis longer. And so the main strategies that we'll employ are, you know, the main things, so we can increase the fill volume. So you can go up to as much as 3 liters. And hopefully by having more fluid in there, maybe you can increase the clearance a little bit. They did studies where they actually took PD patients and put them sort of behind a curtain and infused different volumes, like 2 to 3 liters. And patients really didn't notice any difference in symptoms or bloating or things like that. The other thing you can do is add an exchange. And so if a patient's on a cycler, instead of being, you know, 8 hours and 4 exchanges, you can go to 9 hours and 5 exchanges, or even just 9 hours and 4 exchanges. If a patient is carrying fluid around in their belly during the day, you can add a midday exchange where, you know, just one, you know, maybe like if they're at work on their lunch break, they can go home or to a sterile area and they can just drain their fluid and fill it back up. And hopefully that will prevent, you know, that clearance loss that we saw a few slides ago, especially in the faster transporters. Or if their patient is doing manual dialysis, they can add an extra exchange. A big issue we see over time is issues with ultrafiltration failure. Usually, you know, this can be if ultrafiltration is poor, if patients are chronically volume overloaded. Again, the most common thing that we'll see here is a drop in residual kidney function. But just like in any of our renal patients who's gaining weight, we have to think about, you know, are they drinking too much? Are they eating too much salt? Is the prescription not correct? You know, maybe it's off for some reason. Sometimes peritoneal dialysis membrane characteristics can change. Usually the patients become more rapid transporters over longer periods of time, and so we have to adjust for that in our prescription. And so, again, if you're desperate, you can increase the dextrose content. You can go from yellow bags to green bags and even throw in some red bags if you're in a jam. There's a fluid called icodextrin, which is sort of a purple bag. It's sort of this newer, like kind of isoosmolar polymer that doesn't get absorbed by the peritoneal by the peritoneal membrane, and it can lead to really good ultrafiltration over a long period of time. There are some risks to it. Sometimes it can cause a culture negative peritonitis. The big thing though is that it can be very expensive, and it can be very difficult to get. Like it was sort of this. When I was a fellow and my attending thought patients needed icodextrin, it was always like this huge fight with like the clinic manager. But again, in certain patients, it can work. And it doesn't have the same risk of hyperglycemia, so it also might be really good in a diabetic as well. I think even as nephrologists, we forget we can still use diuretics in patients who are on dialysis. Like, you know, high doses of loop diuretics can be really, really effective here. So oftentimes on our PD patients who have issues with volume, if they have some significant residual kidney function, you can give them 80 milligrams of Lasix a day or even add a distally acting diuretic. And, you know, that will help. Obviously, you're not going to make the kidney function any better, but you even if you increase that urine output a few hundred milliliters a day, that's a lot less work the cycler has to do to pull off, you know, to pull off volume. And then if a patient is a rapid transporter, as might happen over time, you can add exchanges or shorten the dwell times. So maybe add an extra exchange on the cycler. In patients who are slower transporters, their ultrafiltration is very linear over time. So there's not really as much you can do. And so these patients often are very difficult to treat. And obviously, if you're totally out of options, patients need to switch over to hemodialysis. And I've had to do that on rare occasions for some patients despite all these strategies, we couldn't get volume off of them. So we'll talk a little bit in the last like 15 minutes or 10 or 15 minutes about different complications of peritoneal dialysis. I think the one that gets all the play and the one everyone always worries about is peritonitis. But patients can also get exocyte infections or tunnel infections as well. And then there's a bunch of non-infectious complications as well. Patients can have pain. They can have issues with the catheter. Maybe they're having pain or trouble with the catheter filling. Maybe they're having pain or, you know, the issue of the catheter is not draining very well. Patients can get hernias. Patients can get bloody dialysate. We'll kind of go through all those a little quickly. So, again, peritonitis, the big complications, obviously, is patients can get hospitalized. It can lead to catheter loss in certain situations where the patient will have to switch to hemodialysis, which, again, results in placement of another catheter, then another catheter back in the belly if they want to go back. Peritonitis can damage the peritoneal membrane. It tends to make patients more rapid transporters, at least temporarily, and so we have to take that into account. And then, again, how do patients get peritonitis? Again, in a patient who does manual exchanges, that, you know, if you do four of those a day, that ends up being over 1,400 times a year where you're, you know, unhooking and rehooking up your catheter. And so even in patients who have their sterile technique totally down, you know, all it takes, even if you're 99.9% accurate, you're still going to get one episode of peritonitis a year. And so there's other in other situations, you can get an exit site infection or a tunnel infection that can kind of migrate inward and form peritonitis. In rare situations, it can be from a secondary peritonitis from bowel issues. Again, and risk factors, again, with manual peritoneal dialysis, you're accessing the catheter multiple times a day more than you would if you were just going on and off the cycler. And also just compromised host defenses. You know, there's potentially just from, you know, normally like the mesothelium or the peritoneum is sort of intact. There's not a lot of, it's a potential space a lot of the time. There's not a lot of volume in there. And the way things adhere is very, it's a great barrier against infection. When we're putting fluid into the belly, we're stretching everything out. So we're going to increase the chances that, you know, that we're going to impair that barrier a little bit. At the same time, all of the sugar that we're putting in the belly could also be a potential nidus for infection. So in terms of prevention, the big thing is just frequent, you know, obviously we train our patients, home visits, our nurses are always available if they have questions. We want our patients to be prophylaxed before procedures, definitely before any type of abdominal, urologic or gynecologic procedure. We should drain the abdomen. And then also, I know there's sort of been sort of this, you know, loosening of when we give antibiotics to patients prior to dental procedures. But peritoneal dialysis patients is a situation where we definitely want to keep giving dental prophylaxis. Patients are definitely at higher risk of getting peritonitis after especially an invasive dental procedure. And obviously, if we notice that every month when we bring patients into the office, we inspect that exit site super carefully. And if we see any type of exit site infection or tunnel infection, we want to be aggressive with treating that before it could potentially, you know, progress to a peritonitis. And so here are some fun pictures. So here's what a normal peritoneal dialysis catheter exit site looks like. You can see that, you know, for the most part, maybe there's a little bit of redness there or granulation tissue, but really it's the diameter of it's pretty narrow. Usually if you push on the tunnel, there should be no tenderness. Obviously it shouldn't express anything. And usually you shouldn't see any redness at all along the tunnel site. And so if a patient ends up getting, this is what a tunnel infection or an exit site infection can look like. If there's a lot of redness, if you start seeing maybe a little bit of crusting around the exit site, obviously if you start pushing on it and trying to express any pus and pus comes out, that's a bad sign. And if that progresses, you can get erythema over the actual tunnel site itself, whereas the exit site might look not as bad. And again, usually if you push on the tunnel, it's swollen, it's tender. If you do these ultrasounds over, you can see fluid collections or abscesses. In some cases, you can actually, if the catheter gets a little bit dislodged, you can see a little bit of that cuff sticking out that I showed you many slides ago. That's obviously sort of an automatic infection until proven otherwise. And so obviously we want to nip these in the bud before patients develop a peritonitis. And so usually we can, almost anybody, even for primary prevention, we'll use topical antibiotics, usually mupirocin or gentamicin cream that the patient will put on every day. If there is an infection, usually you can get away with giving a first generation cephalosporin for a couple of weeks. If things aren't really getting better. You can try broader coverage. Again, this is a skin issue, so usually the infections are gram positive. But again, if you're getting desperate, you can try to treat for gram negative infections as well. And then finally, if you know, as a last resort, if we're not making this any better, or if the patient progresses to peritonitis, the catheter needs to come out. If there's no evidence of peritonitis, you can actually do a simultaneous, removal and replacement. You can take the catheter out of one side and then immediately put one back in the other side. And if you sort of craft the peritoneal dialysis prescription well, and kind of do some maneuvering, the patient can stay on peritoneal dialysis and never have to transition to hemodialysis, which is, my peritoneal dialysis patients, like they beg me in the rare cases they've had this, like, they're like, do anything, just don't put me on hemodialysis. And so, you know, we try to do the best we can to accommodate them. And so in terms of peritonitis, it's pretty rare for a patient to present with like florid sepsis in this situation. Usually the big complaints that are asterisked here are patients are coming in sort of with like this diffuse abdominal pain. They may have some tenderness on exam. Maybe it's rebound tenderness. And then the big thing is also cloudy effluent. This is easier to diagnose in patients who do manual exchanges because they actually look at their fluid several times a day. In patients on automated peritoneal dialysis, usually the fluid just sort of going down the drain. But sort of what we're taught or what the patients were taught is that, and I guess this is sort of antiquated. Let me try to help me come up with a newer, newer technique. We're taught that a patient should normally be able to read the newspaper. Like if they put a bag on top of their fluid, they can still read the newspaper through. But I don't think anyone reads newspapers anymore. So we need something else. And so obviously if the fluid gets very, very cloudy, you obviously won't be able to read anything through that. And that's often a sign that a patient has peritonitis, especially when combined with abdominal pain. Sometimes these patients can have fever. Sometimes these patients can have nausea or vomiting. And again, sepsis, like florid sepsis is pretty rare. And for that reason, often if a patient notices cloudy fluid or some abdominal pain, we can actually quickly diagnose and treat this without a patient ever coming to the hospital. And so to diagnose it, if a patient has fluid in their belly, if they're in the hospital, we'll have one of our peritoneal dialysis nurses come in, check a cell count, gram stain, culture, and sensitivities. And this is actually, to diagnose PD peritonitis, it's much more sensitive than, say, like, you know, liver SBP. You only need whereas I think you need 250 white cells for liver SBP, you only need 100 white cells and greater than 50% neutrophils to make a diagnosis of PD peritonitis. Again, because the main etiology is usually a touch contamination, usually we see gram-positive bugs, usually, you know, coag-negative staph or strep species. But, you know, staph aureus, MRSA, enterococcus can play a role as well. Because the abdomen is involved, we can see some gram-negatives as well. Usually you can see things like E. coli, Klebsiella, Pseudomonas. One of the big fears we ever have is if a patient has a fungal peritonitis. That's really, really bad. We don't like seeing that. So a question I always get from patients, and I've seen some patients come in with what looks like just a kind of a run-of-the-mill peritonitis, and I look and I see there's immediately like a surgery consult to pull the catheter right away. It turns out in a majority of patients with kind of run-of-the-mill peritonitis, you do not need to pull the catheter. And again, that's a huge deal for a patient, especially because with peritonitis, you can't just do a simultaneous replacement. You know, the patient will need to switch to hemodialysis for several weeks. And so usually what we'll do when we don't have any information back is we'll give empiric antibiotics. Usually you want to treat gram positives, but also gram negatives as well. So usually something like vancomycin or cefazolin combined with a third or fourth generation cephalosporin like ceftazidime or cefepime. And obviously once you have a positive culture, then you can kind of adjust your antibiotics accordingly. The one, you know, tricky thing we have to deal with is that a good percentage of these cases are culture negative. And so we don't have the ability, you know, usually we have to keep dual coverage for those patients for a couple of weeks. And one of the advantages that we have of having access to the peritoneal cavity is that we can treat this infection, you know, dead on. We can actually give antibiotics intraperitoneally. Usually if a patient's coming into the hospital, they'll have an IV access and it's easier just to get an IV antibiotic in. If a patient in the rare case that they're septic, it's better as well. But if a patient comes into the office and they don't have an IV access, we can just immediately mix some of their fluid with whatever antibiotic we need and put it in there. Usually the antibiotics, you can sort of do them a number of ways. You can either put the antibiotic just in like the long dwell. So for the cycler patients, you keep it in during the day, or for the manual patients, you do it at night when their dwell time is the longest. In some cases, you can actually do continuous dosing. You can put instead of putting a lot in one dwell, you can put a little bit in every dwell. Usually, we'll treat this for about 2 or 3 weeks. And then how we monitor this is we'll monitor. You know, obviously, we'll see if patients' fluid is getting clearer. Is their abdominal pain getting better? Every couple of days, we can repeat cell counts and cultures to make sure everything is getting better. There is some controversy about whether because fungal peritonitis is so bad. So there's a controversy whether or not we should give patients sort of automatic like fluconazole or nystatin just to prevent a fungal peritonitis. And then the other thing we have to do is adjust our prescription. Some of these patients are prone to being faster transporters, and so during this period of time, so we may need to adjust their prescription accordingly. And obviously, we want to keep an eye on the exit site and make sure that's not getting infected as well. And then in terms of when to remove the catheter, basically, if the patient's not getting better, if the infection keeps coming back, if there's fungal peritonitis, that's like an automatic removal. There's like no questions asked. The thing has to come out. And obviously, if there's any type of intra-abdominal pathology, like a perf or an abscess, usually if the catheter does come out, you want to wait about a month, finish antibiotics, let everything clear up, and then you can have the patient go back to the surgeon to put the catheter back in. And then quickly, this is perfect timing, I hope. Non-infectious peritoneal dialysis issues, bloody dialysate, we'll talk a little bit about pleural effusions, dwell pain, or the catheter won't drain, and hernias, which often have to be fixed before they get worse or strangulated. So this is a bloody dialysate. Usually the main cause of this is we forget in Boca Raton, we'll treat women of childbearing age. And so in patients who are having menses, this can actually cause a hemoperitoneum. Usually it's painless and it's benign and hopefully should go away as menses kind of quiets down for the month. Sometimes you can see this after a peritoneal dialysis catheter insertion, or if their vintage of dialysis is as polycystic kidney disease, if you have a cyst rupture, that can lead to hemoperitoneum as well. Just remember, just like with hematuria, it doesn't take a lot of blood to make the fluid look like this. So this obviously looks very bad, but it's usually not as bad as it suggests. And obviously if it doesn't get better, that's an issue, but usually the main causes are relatively benign. Pleural effusions. So this is sort of a similar mechanism to the hepatic hydrothorax you might see in patients who are cirrhotic. Usually we have these sort of either congenital or acquired, we have these like microscopic pores or communications between the pleural and the peritoneal cavities. Usually for some reason this tends to happen on the right side, and usually it happens in people just starting peritoneal dialysis. So obviously if you put fluid in someone and they start getting short of breath or coughing and you do an x-ray and you know it's a giant pleural effusion, you can actually do a thoracentesis, and you can look for things like glucose or creatinine. And obviously, if those are very elevated, it likely suggests that there's a communication. Sometimes you can maneuver the prescription. A lot of these patients end up having to get switched over to hemodialysis, however. But in some cases, we actually enlist the help of our thoracic surgery colleagues to do what's called a talc pleuridesis to try to seal off that space to enable them to go back to remaining on PD. And then finally, patients can have pain, usually obviously it can be from peritonitis, but this is usually transient. Sometimes catheters can get malpositioned, they can get wrapped in omentum or near the bowel. Sometimes just having high glucose content, sometimes the lactate being in there can cause some catheter pain as well when the fluid is going in. Sometimes the catheter has to be manipulated or replaced. Sometimes you can do what's called a tidal prescription, when instead of draining the abdomen totally dry, you drain about 80% of it. Some of those patients tolerate that a little bit better. Or you can even try to injecting some bicarbonate into the fluid, however you don't do that too commonly. And then finally, we have outflow failure. So a lot of patients will complain that their alarm is going off in the middle of the night and that they can't get fluid out of their catheter. The causes number 1 through like 30 are constipation. And so usually the first thing we'll always try is giving a patient a a regimen of laxatives or stool softeners to see if that helps. If that doesn't work, usually we'll do an X-ray to look for the position of the catheter. Remember, a very long time ago, I showed you that the catheter should appropriately be placed down in the low pelvis, but sometimes it can migrate. In this case, it kind of is up near the left hemidiaphragm. And obviously, that catheter might need to be fixed. Sometimes the catheter can get occluded, whether from like omentum kind of wrapping around it, or intraluminal, could you have a clot or fibrin that's sort of preventing the outflow? And so basically, again, we'll give laxatives. If we think there's an intraluminal fibrin, we can put heparin in there and try to, you know, try to help break that up. There is some thought that you can actually put TPA in the catheter as well and let it dwell a little bit. And then you can do catheter manipulation and repositioning. So there's a procedure interventional radiologist will do sometimes where basically it's a pretty crude procedure. But they just, like, under fluoroscopy, they stick a wire, like a coat hanger, basically, into the catheter, and just sort of, like, flop it around, and they try to just move the catheter down, and I guess they can see on fluoroscopy where it's going. Obviously, it's not as it's less invasive, but maybe not as successful as an actual surgical evaluation, where they can actually do a laparoscopic procedure and see what's actually wrong with the catheter. Sometimes they can even, like, remove omentum, or a surgeon can actually direct the catheter down into the pelvis and even put a suture in there so it stays in the pelvis, or in a worst case scenario, if they can actually replace the catheter. So in summary, peritoneal dialysis is still relatively uncommon, but incidence of home therapies is growing. So as I try to get more patients on peritoneal dialysis, you're going to see more patients on peritoneal dialysis. And despite, you know, some of the complications that I went over, I think it's safe, and it allows patients to live more independently outside of the, you know, kind of over-medicalized dialysis setting. So I'm done. Here are cute pictures of my kids and my dogs as I tend to end all my lectures with. Thanks for your attention. Do you have any questions? Yeah. I don't know the exact data. A lot of our patients are still on phosphate binders, but again, it's like, you know, usually it tends to be a little, because patients are continuously dialyzing, you will get a little bit of removal, but it's not nearly, but a lot of patients still do require binders. You can actually use a high calcium dialysate. I think I used it once in fellowship, but usually, again, if there's issues, usually we give the same bone mineral drugs, you know, activated vitamin D, agonist, you know, replacement, Sensipar, things like that. It's usually, yep. It's different. So I think it's usually grams per liter. So you might, and so it's all based on like the total volume of the dialysate. Like, for instance, vancomycin, you only have to use like once every 4 days usually in a PD patient, and it's like in one dwell. But so I think like some of the other ones, you can either do one dose in a long dwell or a lower dose in every single bit of fluid. Yeah. I mean, it's fine. Usually, yeah, it doesn't matter at all. I mean, usually, when the patient gets transplanted, they'll take the PD catheter out at the same time, just because it obviously you don't want to. If a patient ends up needing dialysis after the transplant, you don't want to do PD on someone with who just had an abdominal surgery. But it's totally fine. Yeah. That's a great question. I kind of forgot to allude to that. So the cycler is actually the size of a carry-on suitcase. It's pretty small and not super heavy. And so you can travel with that. And and you don't even have to pay the $25. I think you get like the medical device exception. But and then what you do, it's just like how you have to arrange a clinic for yourself when you're a hemo patient. If you're on PD, you basically say, oh, I'm going to, you know, this place for a week. And they'll actually, just like how you have, like usually a truck will come and bring supplies and fluid bags to your house. They'll actually deliver them to wherever you're going. So then you can do dialysis when you travel. Yeah. So it's definitely possible. Like I've had patients who, I've like, you know, driven to Chicago, and sometimes they'll put the fluid in their car. Sometimes they'll get it flown in to wherever they're going, and all they have to do is take their cycler. Once I had a patient do a manual exchange at a rest stop when he was driving. That did not go well. He got peritonitis. He never did that again. Don't do that. Awesome. Thank you so much.